The following podcast is sponsored by Financial Sense Wealth Management. To learn more about our investment services, go to financialsense.com or give us a call at 888-486-3939.
We are looking for a pretty significant deceleration as we go into 2022. Right now, you know, obviously 6.5% growth in Q2, probably more than that in Q3, but then we're at 1.5 to 2 by the second half of 2022.
The big question is, how much is this variant going to impact consumer confidence? And now we know the answer, a lot. 70.2, this is a miss times 10.
Oh, you're currently paying more for nearly everything, you know this. That's according to the Producer Price Index, which says prices rose an average of 7.8% from July 2020 to this year. It's the largest jump ever recorded on that metric.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team.
U.S. stocks ended roughly flat this week, though a small gain for the Dow and the S&P 500 was just enough to make both indices reach new record highs. Hi, I'm Chris Sheridan, and welcome to this week's edition of the Financial Sense News Hour. Coming up for our market technician this week is Bruce Fraser at StockCharts.com. Then energy expert Robert Rapier explains why anything that the U.S. does when it comes to lowering carbon emissions will be a drop in the bucket compared to the growing amounts of carbon being produced in China, India, and the wider developing world. Lastly, Chris Poplava joins us for this week's Smart Macro edition and says there are some encouraging signs when we look at the most recent data for the Delta variant, which appears to have peaked globally. So he delves into that data a bit more, looking at death rates in various regions and how this relates to our own macro outlook here at Financial Sense Wealth Management. But first up, here's Ryan Poplava to discuss what moved the markets this week.
Well, let's take a look at this week's news and catalysts driving the financial markets. I think one of the main drivers recently has been the action in treasury yields, again, as a main driver for rotations we're seeing in stocks as well as the dollar and commodities. Last week, strong economic reports in the ISM numbers and jobs reports led to a correction in treasuries, causing interest rates to rise. At one point, the 10-year treasury was yielding 1.12%. just last week, and the high this week was 1.37% on Thursday. This week, there was some volatility in the yield as rates spiked on the passing of the bipartisan infrastructure plan in the Senate earlier, and dropping again with the CPI print that moderated to a year-over-year increase of 4.3% from 4.5% for core CPI in July, and then hit its high Thursday on a hot producer price index of 7.8% year-over-year before settling back down 1.3% last I checked intraday on Friday on weak consumer sentiment data. So really back and forth on a lot of economic news, which has been a little bit mixed on the inflation front, but still up. I'll get deeper into those economic numbers here in a second, but the reason I'm concentrating so much on the yield is due to the influence we've seen in stocks, the dollar, and commodities as a result. The rotation has shifted once again into the reflationary camp as interest rates have risen. That means we've seen outperformance in industrials, financials, and basic materials stock names. Meanwhile, tech stocks and growth names have been a place where that money is rotated out of. So now let's focus now on the inflation story this week, because it's mostly up, but the CPI report was a glimpse of maybe a reprieve many in the bond market were hoping to see, and the result of a very strong 10-year note auction raising about $41 billion. The bid-to-cover ratio was the highest since May of 2020, which shows, you know, very strong demand, and according to Jefferies, LSE was said to be one for the record books. The very strong auction is leading many to consider that yields will fall in the coming weeks. Now let's get back to the CPI report. That's the Consumer Price Index. The 10-year yield actually rose on the news despite the moderation in year-over-year comparisons. The CPI rose 0.5% in July, but core, which excludes food and energy, rose 0.3%, which was below consensus. And again, the year-over-year CPI was unchanged at 5.4%, while core decelerated from 4.5% to 4.3%. And that's what the market focused most on and led to the strong bond auction. Now, Greg McBride, chief analyst at Bankrate.com, said it in a note, even though the Federal Reserve's preferred inflation metric is not the consumer price index, it's actually the CPE index, don't expect today's numbers to quiet the calls for the Fed to dial back crisis-era actions for fear of stoking further price increases. The transitory or sustained debate will nonetheless continue. And that leads me to the Fed speak, which was loud and clear this week. Kansas City Fed President George, Dallas Fed President Kaplan, Atlanta President Bostic, Boston Fed President Rosengren all suggested the Fed should consider tapering asset purchases sooner rather than later, with the likelihood of tapering comments to come out of Jackson Hole running high later this month on August 26th through 28th, with possibly a formal announcement at the September Fed meeting. Now, Chicago Fed President Charles Evans was the only voice not ready to support tapering that I can recall this week. It was hard to keep track of all of them at once. They were popping up out of the woodworks everywhere I looked on TV and in articles. I guess that's why I think this was a bit more than a trial balloon for Jackson Hole later this month. And we'll probably continue to hear more through the weeks ahead. The producer price index for final demand went up 1% in July. So year over year, that's about 7.8%, up from 7.3%. So a hot number, and it increased. Producers are paying more and could mean lower profits if unable to pass those prices to the consumer. Like we just saw in the consumer price index, prices are rising, but there was a bit of a deceleration here. Import and export prices were up in July as well and accelerated, and I doubt there will be a big improvement there when we just heard that a major Chinese seaport shut down due to COVID. That was announced on Friday. But the data didn't seem to affect bonds as much as the University of Michigan's Consumer Sentiment Index, which declined in August to 70.2 from 81.2 in July. So a big drop, and the concerns in the survey wasn't just about Delta COVID. It was about personal finances and the prospects for the economy, which include inflation and unemployment. The stock market didn't seem too annoyed with the report and was largely unchanged on the day, but we did see a big drop in Treasury yields as a result of that news. Talking about COVID, we've seen that cases are on the rise in the U.S., but there has been a drop-off in global cases. But, you know, focusing here on the U.S., Southwest Airlines issued downside guidance for their third quarter revenue estimates, and the stock finished higher on the day despite that news. And then Friday, Airbnb said it expects a hit in bookings as well and suggests the recovery has been quite varied due to the different vaccination rates across the regions. And if you look at the transports, we've seen an increase in the Dow Jones Transport Index this week, maybe as a result of the infrastructure bill that got passed and what that can mean on activity. But despite the Delta variant concerns in the U.S. and the back and forth between the House deciding whether to vote for the bipartisan infrastructure deal or not, stocks carried higher through the week. But oddly, I really want to point this out. When you look at the S&P 500 sectors, the two best performers were materials. Okay, no surprise, you know, reflation's coming back. Followed by consumer staples, which are interest rate sensitive. That's an odd couple sitting together, and maybe our technician this week can sort that out. So let's move on to that.
We might not be looking at a recession for four more years. FS Insider spoke with Lauren Seidel Baker at ITR Economics this week to get an update on their outlook for next year's slowdown in 2022, when they expect the next recession and depression to hit the U.S. Lauren discusses their dashboard of leading economic indicators, how confident they are in a number of their forecasts, and how demographics, debt, and inflation are converging this decade regardless of what politicians or which political party is in power. Here's a clip of what she told listeners this week on FS Insider.
Nine of those indicators are now back in declining trends. So what that means, by mid-2022, we should start to see some rate of change decline.
If you want to listen to this full interview, go to financialsense.com and click the subscribe button.
Is your portfolio prepared for higher inflation? Don't let higher inflation erode the value of your hard-earned wealth. Let us put our financial expertise to work for you. Contact Financial Sense Wealth Management today at 888-486-3939 or email us at grow@financialsense.com. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Well, this week, Financial Sense would like to welcome back Bruce Fraser of Wyckoff Trading to talk about the financial markets and the opportunities and risks therein. Bruce, I followed your work on StockTrackers.com, and that's why we wanted to invite you to the show. But for some of our listeners, I think you've been on our show at least a couple of times. For anybody that's just now tuning in and maybe hasn't heard of your work, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, my career was as an RIA, Registered Investment Advisor. I was a portfolio manager for many, many years. We were very much an economic shop where we did a lot of cyclic economic research. One of my partners was Martin Pring, very famous economic researcher, written a lot of books. And wow. So, you know, I sat by his side for many, many years. And so I have a definite economic orientation to how financial markets, stocks, bonds, inflation, commodities, et cetera, fit together in the real world. And I'm very much a visual person, so I love to visualize data and visualize these concepts on charts. And so that's really sort of my passion. And then for 30 years, I taught graduate school at Golden Gate University in San Francisco, a wonderful university. And I taught in the only program that taught technical analysis on a graduate level. We actually built the program from one class up into a whole program where students could come out of the graduate school with a certification for being technical analysts. Put a lot of people in the industry that have been very successful. And one of the themes or paths in that program that a student could take was the Wyckoff method. And the Wyckoff method was based on the work of Richard D. Wyckoff. And at the time we took it over, it was sort of, fallen out of favor, kind of forgotten. And I've been using the Wyckoff method for 40 years. And so we started teaching Richard D. Wyckoff's methodology, which was actually at the time, in the early 30s, was a correspondence course that he put together at the end of his life. And then that became the basis for the whole Wyckoff trading method, which was totally based on chart reading. But the way that Richard D. Wyckoff reads charts is so different from the way that you think of classic technical analysis. And so the approach to how you segment the structure of, say, an accumulation before a stock goes up, it builds a cause, or there's a process of stock going into strong hands before the uptrend begins. And there's very much, and these are the rules that he established, or the laws, he called them laws of cause and effect, effort and result, and so on, supply and demand. And these were all laws that were based on the idea that for a stock or the market to go up, stock had to go from weak hands to strong hands. And that the very strong hands in the marketplace are the very large operators who would accumulate, absorb shares of stock, and then hold them for a very long time, effectively making the stock scarce, difficult to buy by other institutions, other, let's say, lesser institutions. And so this is sort of the process. And we look for these characteristics or these footsteps in the way the charts are behaving. And so we have the cyclicality of accumulation, markup, distribution, markdown. And so that's what I write my blog about. And I really like to do that. I'm not teaching in the classroom anymore. Did it for many, many years as an adjunct. I was not a full-time professor. And so my registered investment advisory career was my vocation. And so in a nutshell, that's what I do. My content is all available on stockcharts.com, which is just the best charting platform out there. And go check it out. There's a lot of free stuff. They generously support my blog. And I also have a weekly show on Stock Charts TV, where I talk about these concepts in the market and the economy and so on, which we're going to talk about some today.
Well, thank you, Bruce, for that very in-depth look at both your background and where you've come from and your thoughts on technical analysis and where they came from. I'm very jealous. You sat next to Martin Pring. I just read his books. I've never really had any kind of mentoring. I'm definitely very jealous.
He's a very dear friend, and we get together often as much as we can. And I remember the first time I met him, I was just starstruck. And he's every bit as good as his books seem to indicate. And he's a brilliant thinker. And I've been of great fortune to have him as a mentor.
I have no doubt. And I appreciate that Stock Charts produces still some of his work.
Yes.
Well, Bruce, let's head into things here for our listeners.
Sure.
And thank you for sending me some notes on some of the things, the areas that you're covering. So I'd like to start off on maybe what you think is the 10 on the scale of 1 to 10, and that's the dollar. The dollar's been fairly weak for the past 18 months, but in 2021 has had some strength due to possibly foreigners buying our stocks or our bonds. Looks like a bit of a cup in the handle here pattern developing. Is the dollar ready to rally further? And what are the implications to your investment plans and what you're telling your listeners around this?
Well, the dollar, good way for people to follow or track the dollar is through a dollar ETN, which is a symbol UUP. And the trend of the dollar has been very volatile in the last, say, 12, 13 years. Big swings up, big swings down. And so we've been tracking those. And interestingly, at the time of the COVID crisis in early 2020, the dollar had a huge spike upwards, which was exhaustion. And since then, it's been in a long slide. And there's a reason for that in my mind. And that is that the Fed has become very, very accommodative with QE and so on, lower interest rates. And this has had the effect of bringing the dollar down, which has the benefit. In some circles, people think this is a benefit of making our exports cheaper, which tends to stimulate the economy. And also it has the effect of putting people to work. But the other side of that, there's always two sides to every coin, and that is falling dollar results in higher inflation or can result in higher inflation. And in fact, into the lows, going into this big trend channel, it's a huge trend line that going into that trend line that goes back, about 7 years, we went down and touched that trend line after much weakness in the dollar for a long time. And at that point at which that oversold condition formed, there was intense concern about inflation. And that was in the early part of this summer. And so inflation started to become a real worry for individuals, the street, and so on. And so here we are. As a matter of fact, today, PPI came out and it was at 1% for the month of July. And CPI came out yesterday, and I wrote it down, but it was over 5%, I think, or maybe it was 5% even. But anyway, inflation is following the weak dollar. Now, I think that the result of that is that the Fed has started to really feel the heat. And they're feeling the heat from the public, they're feeling the heat from Wall Street, and so on. And I believe that underneath the surface, the Fed is actually doing things to start to address this issue of the immense amount of liquidity that they've been putting in the system and all the things that they've been doing to really create inflation. And so the big question for us as investors is what does this do to the stock market? What does it do to the bond market? So that's sort of where I think we are. It's a very important juncture. Since that time, really literally in 2021, the dollar has stopped going down and has started to go into a trading range. And so the big question is it just pausing before it breaks down from this big trend line, or does it start to rally for a while and show strength in the dollar? And so this is the thing that we're really effectively assessing right now.
I'm with you 100%. In our portfolio management, this is the 10, like you've mentioned, that we're looking at and is just deciding what we might possibly do. If it breaks out from this trading pattern, it might significantly shift our thinking as well as our portfolio. So I agree with you 100%.
Yeah, so it's a very difficult thing. It's like I have great empathy because both my career a while back, but in our careers, we're basically trying to protect and grow client capital. And you look at, say, the interest rate in the treasury note, treasury bond market, and the interest rate is down around 1.5%, some in that neighborhood. And then you look at if you have a portfolio of yielding stocks, right now, based on CPI numbers, which are coming in at a clip of around 6% annually, the yield can't overcome, the yield in a portfolio cannot overcome the inflation rate. And so that really is a problem for investors right now.
Especially savers that want to be conservative.
Terrible. And we do the best we can by trying to navigate financial markets, stocks and bonds, and do the right thing. But the other part of this that's so interesting is that I went back, Ryan, and I looked at, I lined up that 12, 13 year history of the dollar, huge swings up and down in the dollar over that period. And I lined it up to the S&P 500. And interestingly, when the dollar was declining from high to low, big swings downward, those tended to be the very best upward trends in stock prices. So a weak dollar has been correlating to higher domestic stock prices in the S&P 500. And so this is a real quandary because we all love higher stock prices, but really what stock prices and rising stock prices have done for investors is to help to create a return that's been able to offset the inflation rate mm-hmm. and the higher cost of goods and services. And so now we're in a situation where, let's say that the powers that be in Washington are concerned about not allowing inflation to get out of control. And so they may act to, say, taper or reduce their inputs into liquidity inputs into the economy. Well, that could also have the effect. One of the things that does is has the effect of causing the dollar to rally. And so if the dollar rallies because, say, interest rates are going up or because there's a slowing of the growth rate of money creation, if the dollar starts to go up, that may actually have a negative effect on stock prices. Or it may cause, I think it's more likely that it just causes the rate of growth of stock prices to really slow. And so it may be that we end up in some kind of a range-bound trading range situation for some period of time. So the Fed, there's a lot of talk about the Fed tapering in the fall, and just the language of them tapering could be a little bit of a shock to the markets, because the markets are just so overextended here. They're very high. Valuations are very high and so on. So it's just a really interesting time.
Well, I agree, Bruce. And before we segue into stocks, because you started moving that direction, I want to back up a little bit more and talk about bonds. You intimated that the Fed is likely to begin moving towards a taper discussion, possibly here at Jackson Hole. And then we heard from Dallas Fed President Kaplan on CNBC on Wednesday, saying that he supported that. Maybe an announcement in September for a formal move in possibly October. What's your opinion right now on Treasuries? As I know, it leads into some of your beliefs on the dollar. And is the bond rally over? You mentioned the PPI print on Thursday was hot, but we know that the CPI number did decelerate a little bit. And we saw a very strong 10-year auction on Tuesday or Wednesday that seemed to cause a bit of a rally in the Treasuries. What does this all mean? There's a lot of movement going on in this market.
Right. And when push comes to shove, I'm really a trend guy, a chart guy. And so I try to confirm all of these concepts with the way that the market is, in fact, acting. And I act on what the market is telling me to do. And so in the case of the bond market at the end of June, we could see that a base had formed in bonds and that they were getting ready to ascend into a bond rally. And so, in fact, that is what happened after that. And it was a pretty good rally. It didn't get up to the highs from 2020 in bond prices. But, and of course, a bond rally means lower interest rates. But it was a substantial move upward. And we got very close to fulfilling what we call we do a point and figure type chart method where we can estimate how far prices can go. And within a few pennies hit our minimum objective for the bond market. I sort of think that the bond market from here, based on that, is in a range bound state now. It's just going to go sideways, probably have some kind of a trading range, maybe volatile, but it'll probably just bounce around in here for a while. And then we're all in a wait and see mode with the Fed. And I believe the Fed's already been acting to taper inside of their FOMC operations and so on. The language that they use is probably going to be pretty mild. And I believe that's the reason that the dollar is now in a trading range. And I think bonds have the potential to, yields have the potential to possibly go up in here for some period of time to come. They don't have to go up a lot, but I think that this will be the result of the Fed cutting back on their bond purchases and their mortgage purchases. So I think that the recent move in bonds is about over. And now I think we have to turn our attention to other asset classes, which to me is always really the stock market.
Great segue, Bruce. Let's do that. Let's look at the stocks. And, I've seen from your work, we had the Dow Jones Industrial Average hit an all-time high on Wednesday. It's been trading in a range for 3 months or so while the transports have been falling, maybe related to airline stocks. Other technicians have said, based on the Delta variant moving through the U.S., but the Dow Jones transports have started to rally here, testing the 50-day average actually as we speak. Is it up and away, or do you have concerns over the transports maybe not confirming the industrial breakout? What do you see here?
I really like the transports in here. Went to the bottom of a long trend channel that goes back into last year, went below the trend line, and now it's attempting to turn back up. I've been making the case that we've had a successful test of a July low in the transports, which have really been underperforming badly. And, the economy rolls on transports. And yes, there are some issues for the airline stocks, but, I like to dig down into the industry groups inside of the transportation average. IYT, by the way, is the symbol for the transportation ETF, which mirrors the Dow Jones transports. And I really like the way that the truckers are acting. I like the delivery companies. I like the railroad stocks. And so I think that there's, if you segment your interests in there and focus on the areas where there's some real recovery and a rally appearing to start, I really think that there's a real opportunity in the transports. And I believe that's just a function of the economy heating up in the second half of the year. And so a lot of that, I think, has to do with the infrastructure bill. And so I think the economy could start to, you know, kick back in, be strong, continue to be strong, really. It's not slow by any means. And I believe the transports will benefit from that.
That's a great call, Bruce. And I agree with you 100% there. Lastly, I wanted to give you just free rein, Bruce, at the end of our interview here, just to focus on other areas that you're watching, other relationships. You know, we've had the mega caps dominating the story of the stock market for the past few months. You know, is it time for small cap to catch up? I know there's a lot of financials in small cap, so I kind of guess if you're making a bet on a small cap coming back, you're probably looking at financials. But value stocks also have been making a comeback here in August. Has the narrative changed from growth versus value? Anything else you'd like to discuss?
Ryan, it's really a bad idea to give me free rein. And, you know, I just warn you in advance. But
and our listeners.
Yeah, right. So I see, I really like the way that the Dow's been acting, because the Dow effectively has been in a trading range since May. And it's just now starting to ascend out of this trading range, which in Wyckoff terms, we call this a reaccumulation structure. And it's like after a long uptrend, it goes into a pause and consolidates and gets ready for another leg up. And so the Dow, which I believe the Dow is also a beneficiary of the infrastructure bill and roads and bridges and all that. But also there's another theme going on that I believe, and we've been really tracking this for a long time. And this is the effects of the mega cap domination is what I call it. And this is the mega cap stocks. This is the super big market cap companies, which we have referred to as the FANG stocks. And so, and there's others too that fit into that description that are not technically in the FANG definition. But there's two levels of growth stocks out there. There's the mega caps, and the mega caps have been really driving the uptrend in the, say, the NASDAQ 100 index, which is the 100 biggest NASDAQ stocks. But those top 9 or 10 stocks have been really the tail that wags the dog. And I see something happening where really since the spring, the second tier growth stocks, which are not small companies. These are very dynamic, well-run, emerging technologies that have been out of favor from a performance point of view. And they have been basically going sideways to down. And you can see that in some different data, like there's breadth data. You can look at the percent of stocks in the NASDAQ composite that are above their moving average, like the 50-day moving average, as a definition of a trend. If it's above, it's an uptrend. If it's below, it's a downtrend. And that has been declining and now is arguably oversold. So the typical stock in the NASDAQ is really oversold here. And you can see this in the way some portfolios are acting. Kind of my canary in the coal mine for this is the ARK fund, which is run by Kathy Wood. And this is not a recommendation. I just follow it because I think it's a representation of really dynamic young growth companies and how they're performing. And the ARK fund has been underperforming now for some period of time. And so the ARK fund made a high in February and has been in a downtrend. It was like around $160 ETF down to under $100 from February to May. Well, now I'm beginning to see these types of funds where the second tier growth stocks are it's starting to build bases, and the breadth is starting to turn up for them. So I kind of think, Ryan, what might be happening here is that we're starting to see maybe interest flowing away from the mega cap names, those 10, just super big caps, $1 trillion companies, and starting to, some of that, those funds are migrating over into other dynamically growing parts of the stock market. And so this, I think, may have the effect of causing these really dynamic, smaller growth companies to start to perform better, while we may be looking at the NASDAQ 100 index, the NDX, and looking at that and saying, wow, it's the rate of growth is slowing. And so that's a phenomenon that I see starting to happen. And so I'm really watching that intently, with the idea that this could be the theme for maybe the rest of the year.
And Bruce, I'm looking here at this the SMH semiconductor ETF, and recently broke out late July, has had some weakness recently. I think JP Morgan downgraded Micron. What are your thoughts here? You know, it's been a kind of in a range bound coming into its breakout point here, actually rallying a little bit intraday, maybe some accumulation. What are your thoughts on semiconductors and maybe other tech industries where you see this money or opportunities, like you're mentioning overall from what you saw in ARK?
Well, one of the really, really big, you know, $500 billion companies is NVIDIA, which is a semiconductor. And they've just been on a tear and have really gone up substantially. There are very interesting companies in the semiconductor space with good growth. But one of the things that's happening with semiconductors, and we're all acutely aware of this when we try to buy an automobile, for instance, is that there are shortages. And so shortages have really sort of skewed, I think, the whole semiconductor space. And so they've been really dominating. And I would almost treat them as their own sub area of tech. And there's definitely some good growth in the semiconductor space, but a lot of recent earnings growth and sales growth has been companies desperately just like buying two and three times the ordering two and three times the number of semiconductor chips that they would normally order because they can't, for instance, they can't build automobiles. They literally has slowed production of automobiles. And so now, as a result of these shortages, it's flowing into the inflation number, CPI. And that's a real issue. So that's kind of I think semiconductors are a very important space. I like to see semiconductors go up because the semiconductors are where speculators like to speculate. And so as long as they're going up, it shows that there's a really good appetite in the marketplace for speculative stocks. And so I think overall, that's a healthy thing, is to see speculators at work out there. But right now, I do see semiconductors slowing a little bit. I think it could be a unique situation to them.
Well, thank you, Bruce. You've done a real service to our listeners, touching some of these aspects and looking where the opportunities are. And Bruce Fraser from Wyckoff Trading, again, thank you for your time. And if our listeners wanted to follow you more, I know you're at stockcharts.com. Is there any other place that they can follow your work?
Yes. As a matter of fact, if they go to Wyckoff, and Wyckoff is spelled Wyckoff, WyckoffAnalytics.com, they can get lots of great free content, not only from me, but from others that are working and educating in that space. And so WyckoffAnalytics.com. And then also I have a Twitter handle, which is at RD Richard D Wyckoff. So it's RD Wyckoff. And that is my Twitter handle. And then other than that, just come right to stockcharts.com. All my content there is free. and you can come in and read my blogs, which I have a big archive that goes back a number of years with all the basic concepts in it. And that's all free. And then also I do a weekly program called Power Charting, which is a Stock Charts TV program that comes out on Friday, and then it's replays thereafter, and then they put it on YouTube also.
Well, Bruce, that's wonderful. You're doing a real service. So thank you again for coming on the show, and look forward to the next time.
Ryan, such a pleasure. Great to talk to you today.
We are now past peak credit growth, which means we're past peak economic growth and past peak inflation, or soon to be past peak inflation. We're also past the peak liquidity surge, and extraordinarily important for people to understand this.
If you want to listen to this full interview, go to financialsense.com and click the subscribe button.
If you're seeking financial advice and how to invest in today's markets, Financial Sense Wealth Management can help. From setting up or providing advice on 401k plans, managing corporate cash balances in a zero interest rate environment, to helping individuals, foundations, and businesses achieve their financial goals. Give Financial Sense Wealth Management a call today at 888-486-3939. Let us work together to help you get on the path to success. Financial Sense Wealth Management has been named as one of the top investment advisory firms in the U.S. by the Financial Times. Let us put our financial expertise to work for you. Call now at 888-486-3939 or email grow at financialsense.com. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Outside of COVID, the most active area of discussion focused by policymakers the world over is on global carbon emissions. Recently, we spoke with an expert at Oxford Spatial Finance Initiative on how we are building a global surveillance system to track emissions 24/7 on every part of the planet via satellite. Well, today we are going to dig into the emissions story a bit more and discuss some things that you may not already be aware of with our next guest, Robert Raper. He is the well-known chemical engineer and energy expert. You may have seen him on 60 Minutes, History Channel, and on a number of different media channels out there. So, Robert, I want to ask you first about all the focus that's on EVs, electric vehicles, as a way to reduce emissions, especially when we think about last week's executive order by President Biden for half of all cars sold in the U.S. to be electric. What do you make of this executive order and just how effective the move towards EVs will help in reducing emissions?
Well, if we can look at some countries as case studies, and I followed Norway for many years, you know, Norway is the tip of the spear when it comes to electric vehicle adoption. They're way, way ahead of us. And their carbon emissions had actually increased. They increased their EV penetration dramatically, and their carbon emissions actually increased. And the reason is their population increased, you know, their economy's growing, and all of those things lead to higher carbon emissions. So it will have an impact, but I don't know that it will have the impact that people are expecting. And California is the same way. I mean, you can look at California and you can see that California emissions weren't affected much as electric vehicle penetration increased, but it may happen in the future that it mitigates them somewhat. The biggest thing, though, people miss on the whole carbon emissions thing is that the U.S. is just not that big a global carbon emitter among countries. Asia Pacific, and this is what I highlighted in a recent Forbes article, emits more than twice the U.S. and the EU put together. Now, that's because you've got billions of people there, and it's true their per capita emissions are lower, but you've got billions of people driving those emissions. And so I've done the calculations before. You know, the U.S. could drop completely off the map. I mean, we could reduce our carbon emissions to zero, and carbon emissions are still going to be growing because of Asia Pacific. So whatever we do is good. We still have the most carbon emissions in the atmosphere of any country, going back to 1965, if you look at the BP statistical review. But going in the future, it's going to be Asia Pacific. And China will overtake us in about 10 years. They will have the most emissions in about 10 years. So it's critically important that we get Asia Pacific addressing these issues, or it won't matter what we do.
Now, I want to point out for any of our listeners that aren't familiar with your work or haven't heard of you specifically, you know, you're a chemical engineer. You've been working in the energy, the chemical, the renewable energy industry for decades. So you're working to solve these problems. You're not a skeptic on these areas. You're actively involved. And I think you have probably one of the most balanced perspectives in this area. So you're just looking at the facts and you're weighing the data and the evidence. And like you said, the case studies that we see with various countries. So we've got to put that out there, first of all. But in 2014, you know, you had this 60 Minutes interview that generated a lot of discussion. You're basically throwing a lot of cold water on biofuels and Correct. The lack of success that we were seeing from that, you know, how this wasn't just going to be, you know, a major panacea or silver bullet that it was perhaps being painted out to be. It sounds like you're throwing a bit of cold water as well on Biden's executive order and the focus on EVs as a way of reducing emissions as well.
Yeah, it's not a silver bullet. I mean, it's back to the 60 Minutes interview, that was about all the money we were throwing at advanced biofuels and the fact that we were doing some of the same things that had been attempted 100 years ago and failed. And so I was pointing that out. I was pointing out they're not properly accounting for their carbon emissions. You know, if you turn wood into fuel, but you use natural gas to fuel the entire process all the way through, you essentially have a gas to liquids process, and you have all those associated natural gas emissions. And so people hear wood to fuel, and they say, oh, that's renewable. But they have these tremendous fossil fuel inputs. And so in that interview with Leslie Stahl, I said, this company, Keyore, she said, what's going to happen to it? And I said, they'll probably be bankrupt by the end of the year because they have been over-promising and under-delivering. And that was a fact. They were bankrupt by the end of that year.
Okay. And so again, when we look at now at this point with all this emphasis, right, that was under the Obama administration. Now we're talking about Biden administration focusing heavily on electric vehicles as a way to reduce emissions. Not quite that easy. Norway, large penetration of EVs, saw an increase in carbon emissions. They have pretty good amount of renewable energy as part of their energy infrastructure. California also, it's just not that silver bullet that it's being painted out to be. So in that case, from your perspective, as someone who's working in this area, actively trying to solve the problem of emissions and transition us more towards a sustainable energy infrastructure, what is the best way or what's the proper mix?
Yeah, the problem is people don't want to do what it would really take. You know, if back to Asia Pacific again, because you have billions of people, this is what's driving emissions, is those people in the developing countries just consuming a little bit more. And it's hard to say, you can't do that. Or you know, you have to, you know, we that's where we really need to see massive adoption of renewables and electric vehicles is in India and in China. I won't say it won't help. In theory, you can see why it should help. It's just, if you look at the data, you can see that, okay, it's kind of a mixed picture right now. It's not clear that it is helping. But I do believe, let me be clear, I do believe that eventually, as more renewables penetrate the grid, it will help.
Okay. At this point, it's not helping to reduce emissions, though, is that at this point?
Not substantially. Not. I mean, you know, pre-COVID, I looked at it pre-COVID. We're going to have to see how demand and all shakes out. You know, we have, the other thing about California is, even though EV penetration has increased, you know, more than anywhere else in the U.S., in the time period I looked at, gasoline consumption had increased. So this wasn't, and again, it was because, you know, economy's growing, population's growing, all these things drive consumption higher. Even if, you know, some people driving EVs are making an impact, it's being lost because of the population growth and the economic growth.
So let's recap here some of the important facts that I think we've related for our audience. I think these are great points to keep in mind. EVs are not a solution for reducing carbon emissions or for climate change, unless your grid is really tied into a lot of renewable energy sources. That's not something that's going to happen quickly, and there's definitely going to be some trade-offs if we were even to do that. Again, you pointed out that the place where we see the largest amount of emissions growing on a year-over-year basis is in the Asia-Pacific region, and they're on track to overtake the U.S., which has been the largest emitter historically, but because of just the, I mean, billions of people between China, India, and the growth of their economies, really, that's where the focus needs to be. And so whatever we do here in the U.S., that's kind of going to be a drop in the bucket, it sounds like. I think that's what you had said, correct?
Right. I will make one clarification. China has already massively surpassed us in annual emissions. It's just that within 10 years, they will surpass us in the amount of carbon they have put into the air historically. So we have the largest, the U.S. has the largest inventory of carbon emissions historically, but China will pass us. And I will say this, the U.S. has seen a dramatic decline in carbon emissions over the last decade or so. And the biggest reason for that, I've analyzed this and looked at it, the single biggest reason is utilities switching coal-fired power plants to natural gas power, which has half the emissions roughly to produce electricity. So that's the single biggest reason. The second biggest reason is renewables, adoption of renewables. But, you know, as of recently, it was still natural gas that was the largest contributor to the massive drop in U.S. emissions.
Okay. And, you know, again, I want to go back to EVs for a second here because there's so much focus on them. Have you looked at the all-in costs or emissions when you consider, you know, all the copper, nickel, lithium, and heavy mining that's required for making them? Well, I mean, think about just copper, right? The amount of copper that is required for an electric vehicle, it's massive compared to a normal ICE internal combustion engine. And I mean, you can see copper mines from space, from satellite, right? Some of them are so large, you're moving a ton of earth. That's got to be emitting a lot of carbon, I would imagine.
Yeah, I was at one of them a couple of months ago with my youngest son. We went down to Bisbee, Arizona, where I think it's right outside Bisbee, where they have this massive hole in the ground. And you just look at it and go, holy cow, that's an incredible engineering feat to dig that sort of hole in the ground. It's looks like a, you know, big meteor hit.
Yeah.
So, I mean, the key is going to be they really have to have a lot of recycling. And I've written about this with lithium ion batteries, which there's going to be a tremendous number of lithium ion batteries that have to be recycled in the future. You know, we're not really prepared for that just yet. Some companies are gearing up to do it, but that's a looming problem that's coming.
Let's talk about solar, because I think it was, you know, this year or last year, Bloomberg did a pretty big piece on how a ton of the solar panels that are being produced out of China, and they're producing, I think, the cheapest solar panels, they're one of the largest producers, that most of those are being produced using coal. So that's an issue.
Yeah, I mean, China is the largest coal producer and consumer in the world. They are just over 50% of global coal consumption, and that is the single largest contributor to carbon emissions. So, yes, if they're producing their solar panels and from coal, and they are because their electricity is so dependent on coal, then the carbon emissions associated with those panels is pretty high. So those kind of things have to be taken into consideration.
Yeah. So there's a lot of things here that, you know, we've been discussing on our show. And again, that you're reiterating here that maybe you have to take with a grain of salt when we're pushing heavily towards renewables without considering, oh, how are they produced? What are the components that are used for producing them? So, you know, let's go back to this larger question. What do you see as being the most effective way at reducing, let's say, you know, you're concerned about climate change. You believe that carbon is, as most scientists say, is the leading cause of climate change. And that's something that we need to reduce. Whether or not you agree with that or not, the fact of the matter is that this is something that we're moving towards, global policymakers are pursuing. So given that fact, what is the best way in your mind, the most effective way?
Outside of the mandates, which I don't think have been very effective, I think price has to be a way. And we talk about back to the solar panels in China. If you start to put a carbon-based tariff on those solar panels, and I mean, I saw this proposed by a writer years ago. He said, you know, because when we outsource manufacturing to China, their per capita emissions for GDP are three or four times higher than ours in the U.S. So when we export that, we're making the carbon emission situation much worse. So the guy said, hey, you know, what we should do is we should have a carbon tariff. And so, you know, that takes into account that exactly, that if you produce a widget in the U.S. and you ship that to China where they're using four times the carbon emissions, you account for that when that thing is imported back into the U.S.
Yeah, and I don't see China or India making any large movements in that direction if it means that it's going to lead to a huge jump in their costs and in the price of the goods that they export. I mean, their economies are largely dependent upon exports. So, I mean, sure, there's some things that we can do here in the U.S. that may help reduce emissions. But again, like you said, Asia Pacific emits more than twice the U.S. and EU together. So in 10 or 11 years, they're going to overtake, China's going to overtake the U.S. in total emissions. Now, one thing that I do want to ask you about, China, India, Middle East, Russia, a number of countries around the globe are pursuing is nuclear. Now, we're not doing that in the U.S. It seems like we're shuttering down our nuclear plants. But, you know, we recently spoke with a climate activist who has embraced nuclear power and is trying to change people's minds about it as being the most reliable source of zero carbon baseload energy out there. What are your thoughts on nuclear?
Yeah, if you do the math, you come to the conclusion that we have to build more nuclear plants in place of the coal-fired power plants and the natural gas powered plants to work in conjunction with renewables. That has to happen, or there's just, I don't see really any way to get there. Now, people say, well, nuclear is risky. Look at Chernobyl or you know, look at Fukushima. Those accidents happened. And I've talked about this a lot. When you have a really, really high impact event possibility, you have to reduce the probability of that to nearly zero. And so what you need fail-safe mechanisms. And that means that, you know, when you have a problem, and the plant shuts down, it shuts down in a fail-safe position. And the analogy to that is a fuse. If a fuse has too much current going through it, it melts and stops the current, and that is a fail-safe mechanism. And we have to have plants that people can be confident are fail-safe. And until we can do that, until we can say, you know, a Fukushima or a Chernobyl is not possible, you know, even then, saying it is not going to convince a lot of people, but we have to prove it out. We have to, you know, there can't be a Fukushima every one or two decades or nuclear power will die. I mean, Chernobyl had a devastating impact on the growth of nuclear power globally. And Fukushima, again, you know, you can look at the inflection point. Chernobyl was a major inflection point in the growth of nuclear, and Fukushima, again, dipped down and a lot of countries said, hey, we're not going to do this anymore. And instead, I think they should be saying, you know, let's figure out how that can never happen again.
Well, and then again, I mean, it seems that the mindset has changed globally. I mean, countries are plowing directly ahead into nuclear with heavy investments in that area. The U.S., not so much. It seemed like that there was some warming up to it. And I know that there are certain areas of like climate activists that have embraced nuclear power. John Kerry, our climate envoy for the U.S. He's spoken favorably about nuclear power. But yeah, it just seems like, I don't know, it seems like we have the technology in place. We've advanced dramatically since decades in the past when we saw Chernobyl. You know, hopefully we learned from Fukushima in terms of having those fail-safe mechanisms in place. We have a lot of automation now that can be used where you don't really even have to have humans there, put humans in danger. A lot of it can be automated or you are operated remotely. So it seems kind of like a no-brainer if you want a zero carbon emitting source of baseload power.
Yeah, we really need India and China to go full force into nuclear. And they are. They're adopting a lot of nuclear. But, you know, if China had replaced all their coal-fired power plants with nuclear power, it would have a major impact globally on carbon emissions.
So maybe that is where we'll see the most bang for the buck, so to speak, in reducing emissions. Because, like you said, EVs are not really a solution in and of themselves unless you have renewable sources tied into the grid. And, you know, again, we see a large amount of coal usage in China and India, fossil fuels. And so perhaps nuclear will be the one thing that could make a dent. You know, I know that you, as a chemical engineer, you work in the advanced biofuels area. You have some patents on a number of different technologies. There has been more talk about taking trash. Lots of trash all over the place. There's a trash problem, right? It's growing, getting bigger landfills are getting larger, taking just all this trash and essentially just turning it into fuel. Now, I'm not sure if that was the same as what you were addressing back in, years back. Are we making some headway along those lines? Because obviously you have two similar problems. You have growing trash, which we need to get rid of. And if you want to recycle that to produce fuels, which we need, there you go. So are we seeing any headway there?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny you mentioned that because I'm working with a company right now to turn plastic recycle into fuel. And then a guy contacted me about 4 days ago, and he lives in LA, and he wants to a trash to gasification proposal for Las Vegas. There is a lot going on in that area. The low-hanging fruit there is, waste digestion at landfills, and that's growing dramatically. And incineration to power, but the problem with incineration, it creates a lot of pollutants. So gasification is a little bit different, but it's, a little bit more complicated. But there, the emissions are more controlled. Yeah, there is a lot going on there because there's a lot of low-hanging fruit. We're going to get to the point where we cannot afford to throw, tremendous amount of waste carbon-based material into a landfill. We need to be capturing that and using it for power or recycling it somehow.
And Robert, as we close, would you mind telling our listeners how they can follow more of your excellent work, either at Forbes, Investing Daily, or otherwise?
Sure. I mean, the main, I have two main outlets that I write for. Forbes, I generally give them 5 columns a month, and it covers the energy industry broadly. At Investing Daily, I write several columns for them. I write Utility Forecaster. We have 15,000 subscribers there, where I recommend different income stocks usually. There's a couple paper portfolios that I run. And then we have another product that they just launched back in April that I write. And it's basically a covered call and cash covered put service. And it's designed for 8% yields, basically. It's a low risk 8% yield portfolio is what I'm targeting. And that we've had a lot of success with that. We've had a lot of big winners already. So those are the places, Investing Daily and Forbes.
All right. Well, Robert, always a pleasure to have you on our show, and we definitely look forward to speaking with you in the future. Chris Maplava is the Chief Investment Officer at Financial Sense Wealth Management, who joins us today for this week's edition of Smart Macro. So, Chris, I want to discuss the weekly investment meeting and some of the notes that you're looking at this week, presenting to our team, starting off with the Delta wave, the Delta surge. You were presenting some encouraging data, I would say, when looking at deaths. So if you would mind, share that data with our audience on what you're seeing with the Delta surge underway right now.
There is some encouraging data where it feels like this Delta wave, which is the Delta variant being more transmissible than prior variants, when it is, you know, hits a country, it hits pretty fast and rapidly, you know, kind of like a forest fire. And like a forest fire, it kind of does seem to burn out because it kind of goes through so quickly. And because of that, I am seeing some hopeful evidence that it's possible that all of these rolling breakouts across the globe may collectively be peaking. So looking at the new cases globally and looking at a 1 week moving average to kind of smooth out some of the noise, it does look like we're starting to roll over a bit. It is too soon to say if we have seen a top, but it is possible because I have seen a little bit of a dip. But, we just have to make sure that we don't have an acceleration somewhere else that pushes a whole global average higher. But there is some hope that we may be near a peak. And the reason why I say that is when we look at certain countries, like, for example, the UK, the UK had a massive spike over June and July. And it looks as though their peak is clearly behind us because new cases have been dwindling from the rate that we saw from a peak in late July. And what was encouraging also was that while cases peaked or arose and almost matched the prior wave that we saw earlier this winter, the number of new deaths in Great Britain and the UK really barely budged compared to what was seen earlier. So only a fraction of what we saw. So there was a huge rise in cases, not so much in terms of deaths. So that wasn't very encouraging. We also are seeing a peak in what looks like France, Italy, Spain, and Germany. When you combine them together, they too have seen a spike in cases, but not necessarily in deaths. And it looks, when you look at the last 2 weeks, it does appear we may have seen a peak in the major portions of Europe. So that is encouraging. However, the one area that is nowhere close to showing a sign of a peak and is really exploding is Japan. Japan, their current new daily case growth is, I would say, almost double the prior waves that they saw over the last year. So clearly, Japan is one of the hot centers of the globe. And so far, because deaths typically lag new cases, it's still too soon to say if we're not going to see a pickup in deaths in Japan, because this is about the time we would expect them to rise if they were. So still hoping that Japan follows the path of the UK as well as Europe, that the pickup in cases is not associated with the pickup in deaths. But the fact that we've got parts of Europe looking like they've peaked, the UK has already peaked, that is some encouraging signs that this wave looks like it kind of burns itself out after, you know, roughly 6 to 8 weeks. So given that we kind of saw a pickup in the U.S. not too long ago, we could be nearing a peak overall. And some states are already starting to see that. So that's encouraging.
Yeah. And if any of you want to look at some of these charts that we're discussing, whether or not it's the globally confirmed new COVID cases, it's the 7-day average and how that looks like it has peaked and it's rolling over. At least that's the hope. We're going to be tracking that going forward, of course. Or some of the other countries that were mentioned, France, Italy, Spain, Germany, Great Britain, and even Japan. And these charts show cases alongside new deaths. And again, they're clearly illustrating the point, as you mentioned, that even though we have seen a big pickup in cases because the Delta variant is more transmissive, we haven't seen a commensurate pickup in new deaths to the level that we saw with the prior variants, or let's say the Alpha, the initial Alpha variant. So that is the good sign. And Japan, it's probably where, would you say that's where we see the divergence between new cases and deaths is the widest?
It is, but again, as I mentioned, cases typically for deaths follow the onset of an infection roughly around 3 weeks. So with Japan recently seeing a surge in cases about a month ago, it still, I would say, is too soon to say that deaths have not risen. I think we still need some time there because there is a lag between the onset of infection and the possibility of death. So again, still too soon to say, but what the data has been showing is that those most susceptible to falling a victim from the virus in terms of of dying are the elderly. And so those populations that did vaccinate the elderly are bringing down overall death rates with this most recent surge. And what it really does seem to bear is that the young population, the children, they seem to be tolerating the recent wave fairly well. I recently was speaking with a nurse. I live in Arizona, and just asking what she's seeing. And the reason why I asked is Arizona started school, you know, a week before the end of July. So Arizona has been in school now for almost 3 to 4 weeks. And I was curious what she was seeing with all the kids now being together, most of them or almost all of them not wearing masks, if they were seeing a pickup. And she said she's seen a massive surge of cases that she's tested for, whether she's was doing antibody testing after the fact or taking PCR testing for current active cases. And she said that it was just a massive surge in children under 12. However, almost all of them have been incredibly mild, almost as weak as a normal cold. She also mentioned she had a nurse friend of hers that worked in the ER in a major Phoenix hospital, and they hadn't seen one child that had been hospitalized yet. So it seems like this recent variant is even weaker than prior variants, but more transmissible. But overall, kids are tolerant very well. She gave me an example of her kids. She has a 9-year-old son and a 5-year-old daughter, and her son had a little bit of a cold and runny nose. So she tested him for the antibody test, and he tested positive for the IgM antibody to COVID. And because of that, she tested her daughter, and her daughter also tested positive. And yet her 5-year-old daughter, she said, was still bouncing off the walls, had no symptoms whatsoever. So in my opinion, in hearing that, just anecdotal evidence, I would have to believe that this recent variant appears to be weaker than prior variants, that given that, there's got to be a lot of children who contracted it but didn't know it, or the parents didn't know it because the symptoms were so mild. So the actual true number of cases could be significantly larger. So it will be very interesting to see as more and more states in the U.S., their children go back to school, if we see a surge in the U.S. And that's partly why I feel it's premature to call a peak in the United States, simply because a lot of the country, the children have not started going back to school yet. So I think we could see another surge in cases later this month going into September, predominantly with children going back to school. But the good news, at least from what I've heard anecdotally, is that most children are tolerating the virus very well. And some of them, or a lot, a good portion of them, haven't had any serious impact. She mentioned the child that she saw with the greatest symptom was a 12-year-old boy, who his worst symptom was a pretty heavy cough. But outside of that, the kids seem to be getting through it pretty well.
Yeah, anecdotally, I was actually speaking with someone over the weekend that was tested positive for COVID, and they had a fever and were a bit fatigued. They're actually a police officer, and they were transporting a number of different people who turned out to be sick as well with the Delta variant. And so he ended up getting it, and I was talking to him for a long time. So I got tested for it. Thankfully, I tested negative, but man, I did not enjoy having that Q-tip stuck way up my nose. It didn't hurt, but it definitely was not pleasant. That's for sure. Let's just say that. But I think big picture, you know, if we were to bring this back to markets and the economy, and of course, that's why we're discussing this, and this is why we track this data regularly, is because if we were to see renewed lockdowns, and not just in certain isolated states or cities, but I mean, we're talking about across the US or other countries, we do see lockdowns in certain areas. But if we were to see that to the scale that we saw before, that's worst case scenario, right? Then all bets are off, right? I mean, then we're looking at a big problem for the global economy again. We very quickly could be going back into recession and seeing the markets tank. That's not where we're at right now. When we look at the data, we're seeing that, yes, this Delta surge is much more transmissive. Cases are picking up, but we're not seeing that huge surge in hospitalizations and deaths to the point which policymakers, politicians, those in authority would say, hey, we need to lock everything down. Right now, most of the conversation and the debate is over vaccine mandates or mask mandates. So we're not at the point where we're debating, do we need to lock everything down? And I think that's the big point that we need to take away from this, right?
I would agree. I really feel that the worst case scenario is off the table for two reasons. Number one, I think part of the reason why we won't is just the appetite for renewed lockdowns is just not there, I think, with the common person in household in the United States. Everyone has suffered a long time of decreased activity, being away from friends, family, and socializing. And I think the idea of going back into lockdowns is just not appealing for the bulk of the country. And then second, looking at data from countries that have a decent vaccination rate, particularly in the elderly, we simply are just not seeing the same level of hospitalizations or deaths that we did in the prior waves. So I think that really is the key element, is the impact on our hospital system and our healthcare overall and workers. So if we do, I mean, we're going to see a pickup to some degree because we are getting obviously cases, but if we're not going to see the same surge in magnitude of hospitalizations and deaths that we did in the prior waves, then I think their odds of a lockdown are progressively lower than if we were seeing the same level and rate of hospitalization and deaths as previously. So those two factors alone, I do feel that the worst case scenario is off the table. However, it could be where the market kind of grinds sideways for a bit until we kind of see that peak in terms of number of cases here in the U.S. The market may want to see a sign of that the worst is behind us before starting to move higher, because that could impact consumer spending, obviously then corporate earnings. So there is that possibility. So I think there is still that headwind that is facing the market right now.
Well, Chris, let's move on from COVID and discuss some of the other data charts and analysis that you recently presented to our team. And that's with regards to some of the downstream effects that we're seeing with the dollar, interest rates, and how that could be impacting other areas of the market. If you would mind, tell us about some of these downstream effects that you're looking at.
Sure. One of the ones that I'm taking a look at is the dollar. And often at times, the dollar begins to rally compared to our developed peers like the euro or the yen and other currencies, mainly when our economic growth starts to outperform those regions. And one of the ways we can measure that is looking at economic surprises and how large they are in the U.S. versus our peers. And what we were starting to see was the rally in the dollar over the last couple of months has been associated with weaker and weaker surprise estimates coming from Europe. So a few months ago, we started seeing the dollar weaken because economic data in Europe was coming in way above expectations, while in the U.S., economic data was only coming in moderately above expectations. So there's better economic surprises in Europe versus the U.S., and as that spread increased, the dollar fell. However, the dollar bottomed in May, and that, to me, partly was associated with the onset of the Delta surge in Europe. So as we saw Europe start to see a surge in their cases of the Delta variant, their economic data began to, it's still surprise on the upside, but not to the same magnitude as previously, so that the premium that Europe was seeing relative to the U.S. in terms of surprises was shrinking, and then we saw the dollar rally. So to me, the dollar is really key to getting things right because it really dictates if you should be in foreign markets or domestic or even the types of sectors to be in, whether cyclicals or defensives or commodities or non-commodities. So the dollar really has been trendless all year. Several times it looked like it was going to break down only in a rally. And then just as a rally looked like it was getting started, it would roll over and head lower. So it really has been in no man's land. And what we have to see is kind of how that transpires. One thing I took a look at earlier this year that you and I discussed was looking at prior bear markets and the dollar. At what point did you know or could you know that it was shifting into a bull market? And what I found was that the dollar pretty much failed at the 200-day moving average, or it failed at the one-third retracement of its prior decline. And when we measure the peak in the dollar from last year to the low set this year, we're already above the 200-day moving average, but we're not quite through the one-third retracement. So while some are calling for a bottom in the dollar, I think that's too soon to say. Really, the dollar is in a trading range. So I think watching the dollar will be very key But for me, I still lean more in the bearish camp than the bullish on the dollar. And part of that to me was, and the reason why I think the dollar failed to continue falling earlier this year after a significant decline late last year, is simply because it became a one-way trade, meaning that everyone was bearish on the dollar. So anyone who could sell probably had sold by that period. And so when you look at the futures market in terms of speculative positions on the dollar, it was one of the biggest short positions we had seen in over a decade. So it was clearly ripe for a contrarian swing to the upside. But if you look at the dollar last 7 months or so with the sideways action, we've seen that sentiment dissipate from extreme pessimism on the dollar to a neutral view to now we're starting to see speculators move towards an optimistic view of the dollar. So if we see the dollar rally into resistance and that one-third retracement, at the same time sentiment is overly bullish on the dollar, that could be, again, a great pivot point for a contrary trade for the dollar to weaken. So that is something we're kind of keeping an eye on, is to see if we're going to be stuck in this trading range with the dollar for a few more months, or if we're going to have a true bottom and the dollar will break through that one-third retracement. That's yet to be seen. I personally lean towards the bear side on the dollar, mainly because when you look at interest rate differentials, inflation differentials, the U.S. Data does argue for a weaker dollar than what we're seeing currently.
And just as we started this conversation talking about COVID, clearly the underlying trends with COVID, whether or not we see cases continue, hospitalization and deaths continue, that has major market implications. It has implications even for specific sectors and asset classes as well. As we all know, you know, the FANG trades, the Pelotons, the Zoom stocks, those all did really well when everyone started working from home due to COVID. So just as COVID has market and investment implications, so does the dollar. And both of those things together are some pretty key fulcrums, I would say, that you need to be watching. And I like this chart that you show where it shows the sentiment in the futures market with the dollar, how we're getting back towards bullishness or frothy sentiment. We're not quite there yet, but that's going to be a key thing to watch. And if we do see a turn one way or the other, that's going to have big investment implications for emerging markets, commodities, and a lot of the other areas that we're investing in and around. Well, Chris, with that said, I want to thank you for coming on once again for this week's edition of Smart Macro. And do want to encourage all of our listeners, if you aren't already, go to our YouTube channel. You can type in Financial Sense or Financial Sense News Hour, or you can watch the weekly investment videos that we're presenting each week with a lot of these charts and data as well by Chris Poplava and the remainder of our investment team. Chris, on that note, would you mind telling our listeners about some of the services that we provide here at Financial Sense Wealth Management?
Sure. We provide a whole host of financial services. We provide financial planning, wealth management. We also do 401k servicing, consulting, and we also assist corporations in managing their cash balance, particularly with interest rates at 0%.
If any of our listeners would like to get in touch with our financial advisors, what would be the best way to do so?
They can give us a call at 888-486-3939.
Chris, it was a pleasure speaking with you again on Smart Macro. We look forward to speaking with you in another 2 weeks. Well, that concludes this week's edition of Financial Sense News Hour and our Smart Macro segment with Chris Poplava. Again, if you'd like to give him a call to discuss his investment outlook or to speak with any of our financial advisors, you can do so by giving us a call at 888-486-3939. We do have a weekday premium program as well called FS Insider. If you're not already a subscriber and you would like to listen to more of our podcasts during the week, it can also be accessed on our website or through a podcast app of your choice on a mobile device. If you're not already a subscriber, just go to financialsense.com and hit the subscribe button. On behalf of Financial Sense News Hour, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.